Hello and welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. I've been away for the past couple weeks, but I am back and we've got some current events. We've got royal news, Hollywood, and of course, lots of politics. We're actually going to start with the royals. This week, our first headline, King Charles has canceled diplomatic meetings after a brief hospitalization. This is by Aaron Vanderhoof on March 28th. For much of the last year, King Charles III has been carrying out his public duties while undergoing treatment for an unspecified form of cancer. On Friday, Buckingham Palace announced that he would be canceling a series of events after experiencing side effects of a recent treatment. The palace said the king was greatly disappointed to be missing meetings with ambassadors on Thursday and a visit to Birmingham originally scheduled for Friday. He very much hopes that he can be rescheduled in due course and offers his deepest apologies to all those who had worked so hard to make the planned visit possible. According to the Times, the king was undergoing treatment for his cancer at a hospital on Thursday when he was briefly admitted for observation. By the end of the day, he had returned home to Clarence House and canceled his subsequent events as a precautionary measure. Palace sources told the newspaper that the side effects were minor and are not expected to affect the King and Queen Camilla's planned tour of Italy from April 7th to 10th. One source added that Thursday's situation was a most minor bump in a road that's very much heading in the right direction. While in Italy, the King and Queen were planning to visit Pope Francis for the Vatican's Papal Jubilee. Following 5 weeks of treatment for a life-threatening double pneumonia, the Pope was discharged from Rome's Gemelli Hospital on Sunday. Citing his ongoing recovery, the palace announced Tuesday that Charles and Camilla would be postponing their visit to the Vatican, though the rest of the Italy tour would continue as planned. Our next headline, Meghan Markle says her podcast will be less Shark Tank and more Dolphin Tank. This is by Aaron Vanderhoof on March 25th. Last year, Meghan Markle revealed that her investment portfolio, which began with a stake in adaptogenic coffee brand Clever, had grown to include somewhere between 5 and 10 companies founded by women, including accessories brand Sesta Collective. In an interview with the New York Times, she said she hoped the experience would be like a dolphin tank, as opposed to the atmosphere of Shark Tank, the investment reality show where entrepreneurs compete for access to resources and mentorship. In the first trailer for her new podcast, Confessions of a Female Founder, the Duchess has returned to the metaphor to describe her experience investing. This is not Shark Tank. Think of this as dolphin tank, she says. These are very friendly waters. It's all going to be good. On her Instagram story, she also shared a behind-the-scenes video of her podcasting setup on a beige couch. Earlier this month, Lemonada announced that the show's first season would include 8 weekly episodes, with the first premiering on April 8th. In the trailer, soundtracked by the KOS song Crabbucket, Meghan explains that the show will involve girl talk along with concrete conversations about starting a business. Through it all, I'm building a business of my own and getting all sorts of practical advice along the way that I'm very excited to share with you, she adds. So join me for Confessions of a Female Founder from Lemonada Media, which, by the way, is also female-founded. In 2022, the Duchess made her first foray into podcasting with Archetypes, a Spotify show that allowed her to talk about her portrayal in the media alongside high-profile interviewees like Mariah Carey, Serena Williams, and Mindy Kaling. After that show's initial 12-episode run, Meghan and husband Prince Harry ended their partnership with Spotify, and in February 2024, Meghan signed a deal with Lemonada. On Monday, Meghan revealed another way that she's continuing to leverage her fame. Following in the footsteps of influencers, large and small, she launched a new Shop My page, which allows her to post links from her closet with the possibility of earning affiliate revenue. Many of you have asked, so here you go, she wrote on her Instagram story Monday to announce that she had joined the site. A little shopping to start the week, more to come. So far, the page includes a Jenny Kane sweater and a pair of St. Laurent slides, both highlights from her wardrobe in her Netflix lifestyle show, With Love, Meghan, along with selections from other familiar brands from her closet, such as St. Agni, Reformation, J. Crew, and Heidi Merrick. It also included a product by her investment, Sesta Collective, a bag that had been in her initial introduction to the brand back in 2023 when she wore it at the Invictus Games in Dusseldorf. And another royal headline, on first ever trip to Estonia, Prince William visits NATO troops and praises Ukrainian resilience. This is by Katie Nicol on March 21st. On Friday, Prince William met with NATO troops and took part in a field training exercise as part of his historic visit to Estonia. The prince, who is visiting the country for the first time, is on a two-day trip to highlight the work of British troops in Estonia and learn more about how they're bolstering NATO's eastern flank as part of Operation Cabaret. William visited the Mercian Regiment to find out more about how the troops are supporting Ukraine. William is colonel-in-chief of the regiment, which is taking over duties in Estonia from the Royal Dragoon Guards. The prince, who was there to witness the takeover, served with the Royal Air Force and will one day be head of the armed forces, arrived at the Tapa military base where 900 British troops were stationed in full military uniform. It is understood that the trip, which highlights the importance of William's role as Prince of Wales on the world stage, has been planned for 6 months. William, who trained and served with the Blues and Royals, where he learned to drive tanks, spent the morning training with troops and was photographed taking the controls of a Challenger 2 tank. The images were posted on the Prince and Princess of Wales' official Instagram page. Clearly at ease with the soldiers, he asked one member of the 1st Infantry Brigade of Estonia about the training and joked, "How's it working with the Brits? You don't have to say nice things because I'm here." UK troops are stationed at the camp as part of NATO's defenses against Russia. Kensington Palace has said that Prince William made the trip to highlight Estonia's efforts to support Ukraine. A spokesperson for the prince said, "Both the Prince and Princess of Wales have been strong supporters of the Ukrainian community since the conflict began. The decision for William to visit Estonia is being seen as further evidence of him fulfilling his role as a global statesman. In March 2023, Prince William made a surprise visit to Rzeszów in southeastern Poland to thank British troops for defending our freedoms. Friday marks the second day of William's official visit to Estonia. On Thursday, he arrived in Tallinn, the country's capital, where he met with Estonian President Alar Karis. The royal also visited the Freedom School, which was established in response to the war in Ukraine, to support students in Tallinn. Speaking to students, he praised their resilience, saying, "It's been a very difficult few years for you guys. Everyone sees that. What I love is the Ukrainian resilience is everywhere. You are all very smiley and very strong and very spiritual people. And honestly, that comes across everywhere." The prince, who received a warm welcome and was greeted with cheers, also visited a workshop focused on renewable startups where he learned about how the country is growing and protecting its energy supply, having recently disconnected from the Russian-controlled electricity grid. Later on Friday, Prince William will be shown new weapons capabilities at the Tapa camp before returning to the UK. We are moving to the Hollywood section. Our first headline, Sundance is officially ditching Park City for Colorado. This is by John Ross on March 27th. It's official. Starting in 2027, Sundance will move to Boulder, Colorado. And luckily, not Cincinnati, the possibility of which was a major concern for attendees this year. After an extensive search that started in April of 2024, the festival revealed Boulder, Cincinnati, and nearby Salt Lake City as three finalists to potentially host the event. Of those, the Colorado City won out. It became clear that Boulder is the ideal location in which to build our festival's future, marking a key strategic step in its natural evolution, said Ebs Berno, Sundance Institute board chair, in a statement Thursday. "We have a profound appreciation for the finalist cities and their communities, including Boulder, Colorado, Cincinnati, Ohio, and Salt Lake City, Utah, who presented overwhelmingly strong proposals and dedicated their time, passion, and commitment every step of the way." Since 1981, the festival, originally under a different name, has been held in Park City, an upscale ski resort town where the median home price is roughly $2 million. Throughout the years, producing the festival in Park City has become increasingly expensive, and the cost for filmmakers and festival goers to attend the event has soared as well. While Park City is a gorgeous backdrop, it doesn't have the infrastructure necessary to accommodate the ever-increasing number of media representatives, sponsors, and attendees drawn by Sundance. This reality, plus the pandemic shutting down the in-person festival for 2 consecutive years, made it necessary for Sundance to find new options for a home. Sundance remains the preeminent independent film festival in the United States, having launched the careers of Christopher Nolan, Chloe Zhao, Quentin Tarantino, Ryan Coogler, and countless other filmmakers. So why Boulder? Boulder is an art town, tech town, mountain town, and college town. It is a place where the festival can build and flourish, said Sundance Institute acting CEO Amanda Kelso in a statement. This is the beginning of a bold new journey as we invite everyone to be part of our community and to be entertained and inspired. We can't imagine a better fit than Boulder. The plan is to utilize downtown Boulder as the heart of the festival and incorporate spaces around Pearl Street Mall for other festival activities. Areas of the University of Colorado, CU Boulder's campus, will also be used as part of the festival grounds. Colorado is thrilled to welcome the Sundance Film Festival to its new home in Boulder starting in 2027, added Governor Jared Polis. Here in our state, we celebrate the arts and film industry as a key economic driver, job creator, and important contributor to our thriving culture. Now, with the addition of the iconic Sundance Film Festival, we can expect even more jobs, a huge benefit for our small businesses, including stores and restaurants. Overall, this announcement seems to have stirred a collective sigh of relief. Boulder was the industry's unofficial pick for Sundance's new home when the matter came up at the festival this year. It's a college town, an arts town, a place with tons of restaurants and bars, and vibe-wise, it simply aligns with the original Sundance location. Sundance's move there will also allow the festival to grow. Boulder is a city of around 104,000 people, while Park City has a population of about 8,000. And you still get the picturesque snow-capped mountains as your festival backdrop. Who could ask for anything more? Our next headline is a continuation of a story. Gene Hackman and Betsy Arakawa were followed by strange man before their deaths, says their hairstylist. By Chris Murphy on March 26th. More unsettling details about the deaths of Gene Hackman and his wife Betsy Arakawa are emerging. According to recently released body cam footage featuring Arakawa's hairdresser, Gene Hackman and his late wife allegedly had 2 unsettling interactions with a stranger in the weeks leading up to their deaths. The alleged interactions are described in detail by Arakawa's hairdresser, Christopher, in body camera footage posted by Fox News on Monday, March 24th. In the interview with New Mexico authorities, Christopher described his deceased client as frazzled and said that she had allegedly expressed concern about being followed by some strange man on 2 separate occasions while out with her husband in Santa Fe. She mentioned to me that there was a man that had parked outside of their gate and followed them, Christopher told law enforcement, on 2 separate occasions. One occasion is when they went to White Rock. They went and had lunch there, and the guy followed them from parked outside of their gate community, followed them all the way to White Rock. She said, Christopher, I'm surprised that security didn't know how he got there, because when we left, I noticed that this car had followed us from the residence to White Rock. Arakawa told Christopher that the man who allegedly followed them pulled out a folder of photos of her husband and wanted him to sign them. The hairdresser noted that the alleged behavior was strange because Santa Fe is not a place of paparazzi and stuff, and said that Arakawa confronted the man. She said she approached him and said, I told him that he needed to have more respect, recalled Christopher. He also claimed that she said the same man followed the deceased couple to a different location on another occasion, offering them a bottle of wine, which Christopher says they declined. The final days of the 2-time Oscar winner and his classical pianist wife have been under scrutiny ever since New Mexico authorities found Hackman and Arakawa's bodies, along with 1 deceased dog, in their $3.8 million Santa Fe home on February 26th. According to activity from his pacemaker, Hackman, 95, most likely died on February 18th from cardiovascular disease, with Alzheimer's as a contributing factor. The New Mexico office of the medical investigator initially determined that Arakawa, 65, most likely died of hantavirus pulmonary syndrome, a rare and potentially fatal disease carried by rodents, a week earlier than her husband on February 11th. But Dr. Josiah Child, Hackman's doctor, recently claimed that Arakawa called him on February 12th regarding an echocardiogram for her husband, a full day after her estimated time of death. Mrs. Hackman didn't die on February 11th because she called my clinic on February 12th, Child told the Daily Mail on Sunday, March 16th. Child claims that Arakawa also canceled an appointment on February 10th, saying that Hackman was sick. The appointment was allegedly rescheduled for February 12th, but, per Child, Arakawa never showed up. She did not show any symptoms of respiratory distress, he told the tabloid. The appointment wasn't for anything related to hantavirus. We tried calling her a couple of times with no reply. Hackman was one of Hollywood's most celebrated actors, winning Academy Awards for The French Connection in 1971 and Unforgiven in 1992. He married Arakawa in 1991 and retired from acting in 2004. Hackman moved to Santa Fe in the 1980s and lived there with Arakawa full-time. He reportedly left behind an $80 million fortune. This next article is a little Hollywood gossip. Pedro Pascal and Jennifer Aniston are not dating, but they do party together. This is by Chris Murphy on March 25th. Pedro Pascal has strong feelings for Jennifer Aniston, but not necessarily in the way the tabloids would lead you to believe. Over the weekend, the two Emmy favorites had a three-hour dinner at the Tower Bar in West Hollywood, prompting gossip rags to speculate that Pascal and Aniston may be romantically linked. But while walking The Last of Us Season 2 red carpet, Pascal shot down dating rumors and clarified the status of his relationship with the morning show star. "Oh, Jennifer and I are very good friends. I would do anything for Jennifer," he said when asked if he'd ever consider to appear on Apple TV series The Morning Show. Pascal went on to say Aniston is great in a crisis situation. She's that person. She's that person to everyone. The best way that I could describe it is if you're in a party setting and you make eye contact with Jen, she just knows exactly what's going on with you and knows exactly how to make you feel. Pascal also got a bit more specific about the type of crisis where the Friends star excels, revealing that Aniston, a longtime cannabis enthusiast, can be a port in the storm for anybody who indulges too much. If you're really high at a party, make eye contact with Jen Aniston and she'll calm your central nervous system, the actor said. You'll be like, "Oh no, everything's fine, I'm safe." As soon as your brain starts to go a little too wild and you start to get paranoid, she'll look at you, get you a glass of water, and you're fine. While one might assume that Lisa Kudrow's loopy, free-spirited Phoebe might be the safest place to land if you're stoned at a party, it seems the Friends character you want by your side is really Aniston's Rachel. Obviously, it's not Courtney Cox's neurotic Monica. Regarding the dinner date that sparked all the rumors, Pascal says the two shared a fun martini dinner at the West Hollywood Hotspot. At the Critics' Choice Awards red carpet last year, Pascal also joked that he'd be down to join the morning show on one condition. "I sleep with everyone on the show," he quipped. "I'm in. All right, I'll be waiting to hear from my agents." And this next headline is going to kind of bridge into the politics section. The best Trump burns at Conan O'Brien's Kennedy Center celebration. This is by Savannah Walsh on March 24th. "In history for all time," David Letterman said on stage at the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, "this will have been the most entertaining gathering of the resistance ever." He was one of many starry openers in attendance as Conan O'Brien received the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor. O'Brien's ceremony, held Sunday night, was the most high-profile event at the venue since Donald Trump's anti-woke takeover of the Kennedy Center began last month. The president, who made himself chairman of the institution despite never having seen a show at the Kennedy Center, was a hot topic at the comedy honors. "My thanks to the people who invited me here several months ago, David Rubenstein and Deborah Rutter," O'Brien said to rapturous applause, according to the New York Times. "I don't know why they aren't here tonight. I lost Wi-Fi in January. I'm guessing they're in traffic." Rutter and Rubenstein, who announced O'Brien's selection for the award shortly before Trump's inauguration, were ousted from the center's once bipartisan board by Trump. They were replaced by the likes of Second Lady Usha Vance, who was booed alongside her husband, VP J.D. Vance, while attending a symphony at the venue earlier this month, as well as Trump Chief of Staff Susie Wiles, Attorney General Pam Bondi, plus Fox News hosts Laura Ingraham and Maria Bartiromo. Trump's overhaul has led many in Hollywood, including power players like Issa Rae, Lin-Manuel Miranda, and Shonda Rhimes, to distance themselves from the institution. But a slew of celebrities entered the building to praise O'Brien and skewer its new overlord. John Mulaney joked that the Kennedy Center would soon be renamed the Roy Cohn Pavilion for big, strong men who love cats. Stephen Colbert declared that two new members were joining the board, Bashar al-Assad, the ousted president of Syria, and Skeletor. Will Ferrell quipped that he had no time to be at the ceremony because he was supposed to be shutting down the Department of Education. As reported by CBS News, fellow presenter Sarah Silverman made multiple Trump jokes that were too vulgar to print. The Hill went ahead and published one of them where she said to O'Brien, "I really miss the days when you were America's only orange a-hole." Speaking to via video, Martin Short said, "There is no more fitting recipient getting the last ever Twain Prize here at the Robert F. Kennedy Center, replacing the 35th president's name with that of his nephew, Trump's current Health and Human Services Secretary." But for all the humor about being the last Twain Prize, O'Brien largely avoided the topic of politics, as he did while hosting the 2025 Oscars earlier this month. Before the broadcast, he told the New York Times that however anyone voted should not be a prerequisite for whether you enjoy the show. That didn't stop O'Brien from making this joke about Best Picture winner Anora. "I guess Americans are excited to see somebody finally stand up to a powerful Russian, or being asked to return as Oscar's 2026 host." During his acceptance speech of the Mark Twain Prize, O'Brien invoked the honor's namesake. "First and foremost, Twain hated bullies," he began, according to The Hill. "He punched up, not down, and he deeply, deeply empathized with the weak. Twain was suspicious of populism, jingoism, imperialism, the money-obsessed mania of the Gilded Age, and any expression of mindless American might or self-importance," O'Brien continued. "Above all, Twain was a patriot in the best sense of the word. He loved America, but knew it was deeply flawed. Twain wrote, 'Patriotism is supporting your country all of the time, and your government when it deserves it.'" After his remarks, O'Brien was joined by a band of dancing Twain impersonators, where he picked up the guitar to play a song alongside Adam Sandler, Neil Young's 1989 hit, Rockin' in the Free World. The ceremony will premiere on Sunday, May 4th, exclusively on Netflix. We are moving to the politics section. The first article is in the media section. NPR and PBS chiefs defend themselves during Doge grilling. This is by Natalie Korak on March 26th. Marjorie Taylor Greene wrapped up Wednesday's Doge subcommittee hearing on federal funding for public media by warning about the quote-unquote propaganda airing on NPR and PBS. Content so radical, she said, that it is brainwashing the American people and more significantly American children with un-American, anti-family, pro-crime fake news. Green's concluding screed could have been expected for a hearing billed as follows: anti-American airwaves, holding the heads of NPR and PBS accountable. The Georgia representative would eventually call for the complete and total defund and dismantling of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, but not before NPR's Catherine Marr and PBS's Paula Kerger faced a litany of questions on everything from coverage of Hunter Biden's laptop and COVID's origins to old tweets and content featuring drag performers. Democrats, meanwhile, questioned why Congress was focusing on the likes of Sesame Street in the midst of shocking revelations that top Trump administration officials were sharing and discussing attack plans in a Signal chat that mistakenly included a journalist. Representative Stephen Lynch slammed the GOP House majority for failing to hold Trump and Trump's administration accountable, adding, "They would rather post up against Big Bird than deal with that." Representative Jasmine Crockett used her time to challenge her Republican colleagues, saying, "The idea that you want to shut down everybody that is not Fox News is bullshit." The hearing was charged from the start, with Green flanked by a picture of a drag performer, Lil Miss Hot Mess, whom she called a monster, who she claimed had appeared in PBS programming. Kerger said the performer was actually not featured in any of the broadcaster's kid shows, explaining that the image accompanying Green was from a digital project made in partnership with PBS's local New York City station and the city's education department. That explanation was not satisfactory for Green, who circled back to the drag performer in her closing statements, playing a clip for them for the subcommittee, calling it repulsive and deeming the performer a child predator. Green leveled the accusation that Kerger lied under oath when she said the performer wasn't featured in PBS's children's programming, with Green saying that the played clip had aired on the station in April 2021 and later been mysteriously removed. "I wonder why," Green taunted. Marr was interrogated significantly more than Kerger on concerns about NPR's coverage as well as her personal social media and appearance track record. GOP Representative Tom Burchett questioned Marr about having called Donald Trump a racist and fascist on social media. Marr told the committee, "I regret those tweets. I would not tweet them again today. They represented a time where I was reflecting on something that I believe the president had said rather than who he is." Marr also acknowledged that NPR had made some slip-ups prior to her tenure as CEO and president, specifically when it came to coverage of Hunter Biden's laptop. Regarding the lack of coverage, she said that the organization's current editorial leadership believes that was a mistake, as do I, adding that NPR should have followed the story more aggressively. As for reporting on COVID's origins, Marr told the subcommittee that the new evidence related to the Wuhan lab leak theory is worthy of coverage, and we have covered it. Former NPR business editor Uri Berlinger op-ed in the Free Press last year, which accused the news organization of being close-minded, was invoked multiple times by Republican members, with Green calling the essay powerful. Green argued that NPR treated Berlinger like a political dissident in the old Soviet Union. He was driven out of the organization and forced to resign. Sounds like communism. She laid blame on Marr, describing her as the ringleader of Berlinger's ouster. Certainly, the media platform can have whatever opinion it wants in a free society. The question for us today as a committee is whether or not the taxpayers should be forced to pay for this kind of thing, Representative Michael Cloud said, questioning the continued relevance of public media. Republican lawmakers have long sought to eliminate federal funding for public broadcasters, with Newt Gingrich failing in his attempt to do so in 1995. Recent calls for defunding public media have reached a fever pitch under the current administration, with even the White House calling to slash payouts. On Tuesday, when asked whether he would be interested in defunding the organizations, Trump said he would love to do that. He argued that they have been very biased, adding that it's the kind of money that's being wasted. The president, however, doesn't have the power to cut government funding allocated to public media, as Congress earmarks money for this purpose. I'm going to pause here to remind you that you are listening to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. We are currently in the politics section in a story about media. NPR says that, on average, it only receives about 1% of its annual operating budget from the federal government via grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, or CPB, which was appropriated $535 million last year for the government and other agencies. However, member stations receive an average of 10% of their funding from the CPB, with 30% of NPR's budget then coming from local stations paying to license national content. As for PBS, the amount of federal funding varies slightly from year to year, but it currently sits at around 16%, according to the organization. On Wednesday, Kurger argued that many of PBS's small and medium-sized stations would struggle to exist without these appropriations, specifically mentioning a station that receives 50% of their budget from the federal government. The PBS chief executive voiced concerns that those stations simply might not survive if funding were pulled. This would be an existential moment for them, she added. Our next headline in the politics section. A Tufts student criticized Israel. Then the Trump administration disappeared her. This is by Eric Lutz on March 27th. "Can I just call the police?" the woman asked. "We're the police," one of the masked plainclothes agents replied before leading her away in handcuffs. The woman, Rumeysa Ozturk, is a Turkish-born Fulbright scholar studying in a PhD program at Tufts University in Massachusetts. She was on her way to an iftar dinner in Somerville on Tuesday when immigration enforcement officers intercepted her on a street corner, put her into an SUV, and took her away. The 30-year-old, who has apparently not been charged with a crime, was transferred to a detention center in Louisiana, though federal judge Indira Tawani ordered Tuesday that Ozturk must not be moved outside the District of Massachusetts without first providing advance notice of the intended move. Ozturk holds a legal F-1 visa and was arrested for engaging in activities in support of Hamas, the Department of Homeland Security said in a statement. "Glorifying and supporting terrorists who kill Americans is grounds for visa issuance to be terminated," the DHS said, but it did not say with any specificity what those alleged activities were. And Canary Mission, the pro-Israel group that targeted Ozturk for her support for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, seemed to point only to an op-ed she co-authored last year for the Tufts school newspaper as evidence of her anti-Israel activism. Ozturk is one of several foreign-born university students to be targeted in recent weeks as part of Donald Trump's crackdown on both immigration and dissent. In another high-profile case this month, federal agents arrested legal permanent resident Mahmoud Khalil at Columbia University in New York, where the Palestinian-born 30-year-old once led protests against the war in Gaza. Khalil was also transported to Louisiana. The detentions are part of a broader Trump crusade against what a senior State Department official described as Hamasniks, protesters they accuse of supporting the terror group behind the October 7, 2023 attack on Israel. "Everyone is fair game," the official told Axios, describing the administration's effort to limit foreign students at colleges that have too many who are pro-Hamas and to revoke visa holders who demonstrated against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's war. "It is an understatement to say this is an assault on free speech. In fact, there is a word for a government that disappears people without due process. This is authoritarianism," Massachusetts Ed Markey wrote Wednesday, as video of Ozturk's broad daylight arrest spread online and in the national media. "We will not let this stand." Thousands protested Ozturk's detention Wednesday in Somerville, and a number of Democrats sounded alarms about the attack on our fundamental freedoms, as Massachusetts Representative Ayanna Pressley put it. But the Republican majority in Washington has remained in lockstep with Trump since he took office, and it remains to be seen if the judiciary will be a meaningful constraint on him, with the administration openly arguing that the federal judges don't have the authority to check the president's executive power. The administration has already brazenly defied a recent court order to halt and reverse deportations conducted under the auspices of the Alien Enemies Act of 1789, as well as one to pause the deportation of a Brown University professor and visa holder. It appears to have ignored another district judge's order in Ozturk's case, with her attorney saying ICE transferred her to Louisiana shortly after Talwani ruled she not be moved from Massachusetts without notice. "This is a perilous moment in America. Civil liberties and basic freedoms are under direct attack by a lawless administration, one that seems to consider itself unfettered by constitutional or political restraints, and has yet to be proven wrong." Our next headline, Trump targets Smithsonian, what his improper ideology order is really about. This is by Issy Lapowski on March 28th. For someone who claims to abhor censorship, Donald Trump sure has a funny way of showing it. On Thursday, the president signed an executive order instructing Vice President J.D. Vance to work with Congress to rid the Smithsonian Museum, and for some reason the National Zoo, of improper ideology that is inconsistent with federal law. The order on restoring truth and sanity to American history alleges that the country has undergone a concerted and widespread effort to rewrite our nation's history. In a supposed attempt to correct that narrative, it instructs Vance to work with Congress to prohibit spending on exhibits or programs that degrade shared American values, divide Americans based on race, or promote programs or ideologies inconsistent with federal law and policy. What ideologies could be inconsistent with federal law and policy in a country whose laws are supposed to protect people's freedom of speech and expression? The administration appears to be writing those rules in real time. Among the programs that Trump wants to be explicitly barred from funding under the order are any exhibits in the American Women's History Museum that recognize men as women in any respect. The order also calls out an exhibit on race and sculpture at the Smithsonian. On the flip side, though, Trump's directive also instructs the Secretary of the Interior to reinstate any national monuments or statues within his jurisdiction that were removed or changed to perpetuate a false reconstruction of American history, likely a nod at the spate of Confederate statues that were removed in 2020 during racial justice protests. In addition, the secretary must ensure that those monuments do not include disparaging language, but instead focus on the greatness of the achievements and progress of the American people. For Trump, the attempt to control what parts of history get shared in the Smithsonian is just the latest attempt at policing belief. The administration has reportedly purged words like women and black from agency websites, scared universities out of so much as teaching students about race, and revoked hundreds of visas for students for protesting the war in Gaza. The irony now, of course, is that while the president is complaining about efforts by artists, curators, cities, and states to rewrite our nation's history, this order appears to be an attempt to do just that, except this time by edict. Next up in politics, Team Trump's security failures just keep piling up. Signalgate meet Venmogate. This is by Issy Lipovsky on March 27th. You'd think a solid grasp of basic security protocols would be given for any White House national security advisor, but Mike Waltz could apparently use some practice. On Wednesday, as the White House scrambled to explain how Waltz added the editor of The Atlantic to a Signal group chat about confidential plans to bomb Yemen, Wired discovered yet another digital security fail potentially implicating Waltz. The national security advisor appears to have left his entire 328-person friend list on Venmo exposed to the public. According to Wired's reporting, the Venmo account in question used the name Michael Waltz, bore a photo of Waltz, and was linked to Venmo accounts that appeared to belong to other White House officials, including Susie Wiles, the White House chief of staff, and Walker Barrett, a staffer on the National Security Council. The account apparently linked to Wiles also reportedly featured a public friend list, including names like Pam Bondi, the Attorney General, and Hope Hicks, former White House communications director. Even more telling, after Wired asked the White House about the Waltz and Wiles accounts, both accounts made their friend lists private. Intelligence experts and security researchers have long warned that this kind of information can help would-be attackers glean valuable information about their targets and find contacts they may be able to manipulate or imitate. Venmo friends lists could also, say, expose the relationship between a journalist and a source. Since Signalgate broke open, Waltz has denied ever meeting The Atlantic's editor, Jeffrey Goldberg, and has expressed bafflement at how Goldberg's number ended up in his phone. Goldberg, meanwhile, has said they've met in the past, and photos suggest they've at least rubbed elbows at the same Washington event. Goldberg doesn't appear to have been among Waltz's Venmo friends, at least Wired didn't mention it, but other accounts appearing to belong to prominent media figures, including CNN's Brianna Kyler and Kristen Holmes, as well as Brett Baer and Brian Kilmeade of Fox News, were. Waltz and Wiles can hardly say they weren't warned about the risks of leaving their friends lists open. In 2021, BuzzFeed used Venmo's friend feature to identify former President Joe Biden's account and map his network of contacts. After that story published, Venmo created a tool enabling people to make their friend lists private. A Venmo spokesperson told Wired that the company makes it incredibly simple for customers to make these private if they choose to do so. But some high-profile figures still didn't get the memo. Last year, Wired also found the friend list for the account associated with Vice President J.D. Vance, exposing his connections to some of the people behind Project 2025. While President Trump appears to be standing by Waltz and other top U.S. officials involved in the Signalgate scandal, including Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, the debacle isn't playing well in the court of public opinion. A YouGov poll found that 74% of voters consider the security lapse a very serious or somewhat serious problem. That includes 60% of Republicans. And some of the Trump administration's biggest boosters are now openly calling for consequences. On Wednesday, Barstool Sports owner Dave Portnoy criticized the administration's attempts to poo-poo the story. "You can't downplay it. You have to sit up there and be like, holy shit, this is a fuck-up of epic proportions. There will be accountability," Portnoy said in a video posted on X. "Somebody has to go down." Our next headline, it's not just Tesla sales. Elon Musk's antics are affecting consumer behavior in other ways. This is by Casey Wickman on March 26th. On a recent late winter day in the historic district of Park Slope, Brooklyn, a handful of cars neatly parallel parked along one of the neighborhood's brownstone-lined side streets bore a conspicuous notice tucked under the windshield wiper blade. These cars weren't ticketed for parking too close to a hydrant or for violating the torturous alternate side parking rules. No, the code they'd violated was a social one in the left-leaning area. The flyer featured a photo of Elon Musk on Donald Trump's inauguration day, hand thrust in the air in an apparent Nazi salute, and a simple message conveying in all capital letters, "Please sell your car." Those cars were all, of course, Teslas. Lately, driving a Tesla means being comfortable taking on a certain amount of risk. Not necessarily for mechanical reasons, though past analysis has shown that the cars have a highest deadly accident rate of all auto brands. Getting behind the wheel of a Tesla now carries a social threat. Are you imagining that dirty look from a stranger as you parallel park? You could return to your parked vehicle to find a "sell your swastika car" flyer or a decidedly more incendiary message. Many Tesla drivers originally opted for the cars, the most popular electric vehicles on the market, for environmental reasons. But in recent weeks, thanks to Musk's actions, even those who haven't faced ramifications have started to worry. Will they think I support this guy? Even America's nice guy dad is getting in on the Tesla hate on. During a recent political event in Wisconsin, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz took a moment to gleefully troll Tesla and Musk. First, he delighted in the automaker's stock declines, saying that he added the ticker to his phone's stock app and peeks in on the price to give me a little boost during the day. And then he offered a how-to for liberals affected with owning Musk's EV. "If you own one, we're not blaming you. You could take dental floss and pull the Tesla thing off, you know, and just take out... just telling you." Reports of vandalism to both dealerships and individual Teslas parked on the street have been on the rise. Smashed windows and spray paint, projectile attacks with Kraft singles, and even Cybertrucks being smeared with dog feces, and perhaps even more shocking in the current economic climate, raw eggs. Some MAGA diehards have now pledged allegiance to the Cybertruck, but that car comes with its own very dangerous set of troubles. On March 20th, Tesla announced a recall of almost every single Cybertruck that has been manufactured. The company evidently used the wrong glue on some 46,000 vehicles, which could result in a large back panel falling off and creating a driving hazard. A devastating JP Morgan analysis of Tesla this month predicted further losses for the company as Musk's White House antics continue, with the report reading in part, "We struggle to think of anything analogous in the history of the automotive industry in which a brand has lost so much value so quickly." People uncomfortable with either the idea of Musk or the threat of Kraft Singles, or both, are getting rid of their Musk-made cars. Actor Jason Bateman was ahead of the curve, ditching his before the election, explaining that, "I feel like I'm driving around with a Trump sticker." Reddit is full of commenters claiming to have sold off their Teslas and found a new vehicle, specifically citing Musk as the reason. Arizona Senator Mark Kelly, who recently ditched his, tweeted that his Tesla was fast like a rocket ship, but his feelings have changed. "Now, every time I drive it, I feel like a rolling billboard for a man dismantling our government and hurting people." Musician Sheryl Crow sold hers in February and donated the proceeds to NPR. One Atlanta-based tech marketing executive, a self-described progressive who has owned two Tesla models since 2019, explained his decision to Vanity Fair. "I actually really like the cars, and I know that the company probably has lots of good people who work there," he said, "but it's time for me to divest from all things Elon." Last week, he became a proud ex-Tesla driver. "Now, that's with Carvana," he said, "and I picked up my Rivian truck last Monday." In addition to ditching the actual car, he sold off his Tesla stock, and once the Rivian he wanted was available, made the swap. He said that he took a slight loss on the sale, but that, "out of curiosity, I keep refreshing the quote every few days, and it's dropping faster than you would think." Brian Moody, an auto industry analyst and senior editor at Kelley Blue Book, told Vanity Fair that those giving up their Teslas for a new car were almost certainly losing money on the deal. Electric cars on the whole depreciate 11% greater than a gasoline-powered car over the same period of time, he said. That's partly due to the gadget-adjacent cycle of technology refreshes on EV, the same way that iPhones seem to lap themselves in capabilities every few years, and it's hardly sticking it to Musk. "Those people have already spent their money," he said. "You're not hurting anybody by selling your used car and teaching someone a lesson." Tesla actually hit its sales peak in February 2023, and according to KBB data, they may never again match that previous mark. Moody pointed out the growing competition from other suppliers. "When Tesla started, there really wasn't much to pick from, and now there's tons of great things to pick from," he said. Jennifer Newman, editor-in-chief of Cars.com, told VF that visitors to the site were seeking out articles on the potential impacts of Trump's ever-shifting tariffs, and that Car.com's American-Made Index, which parses data to help consumers understand the domestic components of their vehicles, is seeing more interest than is typical. Additionally, in February, 2.1% of surveyed visitors to the site said that they would consider buying a Tesla, Newman said. By March, that had dropped by half a percentage point to 1.6%. It's a shred of the overall auto buyer pie, but a roughly 25% drop in consideration in a month is nothing to sneeze at. Other EV companies have seen a dramatic shift in the other direction. Rivian jumped from 1% in February to 1.3% in March. In the same time frame, Polestar went from 0.6% to 1.7%, and Lucid zoomed from 0.4% consideration to 1.5% in a month. So Tesla, in theory, is losing consideration, Newman said, while the other EV-focused companies gain. The confusion and heightened feelings around Tesla and Musk present an opportunity for other auto companies to swoop in and take on the role of cool guy, eco-friendly car du jour. New data shows that 11% fewer new Teslas were registered this January versus the same time last year, though EV registrations in general, including rival brands, are up 44% in the same period. Yet Carvana data shared with VF shows that 88% of EV owners say they'd buy another EV in the future. Millennials, the most politically liberal generation ever, according to voting data, were the largest segment of EV buyers on Carvana, accounting for 65% of purchases in quarter two, 2024. Rival American-made EV company Rivian seems poised to take up the mantle. The automaker has been mounting a semi-stealth cool car campaign in recent months. Earlier this month, Rivian put up an electric joyride activation at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas, that allowed attendees to prowl a mountain of dirt in one of the company's outdoor adventure-targeted EVs. They also hosted the Electric Roadhouse Lounge as the festival's headline sponsor. That Austin is Musk's new home base seemed to be a cherry on top. Rivian is also a sponsor on IMO with Michelle Obama and Craig Robinson, a new podcast co-hosted by former First Lady Michelle Obama and her brother, Craig Robinson. In the show's second episode, featuring actor Issa Rae as a guest, Robinson divulges that while we're out here in LA, Rivian hooked me up with a vehicle to tool around in, and Obama seems interested, sharing that she has recently started driving a bit with the permission of the Secret Service. Further details about getting behind the wheel? It's a secret, she says. Enthusiastic alignment with a beloved Democrat family shot straight into the ears of listeners. This is bought advertising, of course, but it's ad money strategically spent. The PR strategy is the inverse of shots of Trump and Musk grinning weirdly from a Model S outside the White House. Rivian hasn't offered direct incentives for Tesla owners, a tactic deployed by Swedish automaker Polestar, whose recent Tesla Conquest program offered a $5,000 lease bonus on top of other deals to lure U.S. Tesla drivers, or trolled them like Kia, whose Norway arm posted a since-deleted cheeky photo of an anti-Musk bumper sticker on one of their own cars. Reading the tea leaves of Rivian's relatively scarce marketing activity seems straightforward. They're placing their product directly in the eyeline of consumers likely to be looking to de-ick their drive, just in time to build hype for their latest model. Though Rivian sales have been on the uptick, the stock has not. In January, Trump signed an executive order eliminating federal tax credits on new electric vehicles, making them more expensive to buy and sparking worries about the charging infrastructure necessary to keep all electric vehicles running. Rivian's stock price is piddly compared to Tesla's and has dropped 23% in the past 3 months, but hedge fund analysts point to Rivian expanding production and facilities as well as managing effectively through governmental headwinds and appear to be optimistic about future growth. Rivian has a partnership with Volkswagen, which has invested $5.8 billion in the company and has announced plans to expand its vehicle offerings, including more affordable models. In February, Rivian announced a $170 million gross profit in quarter four of 2024 and a year-over-year increase in sales. And yet, there are the politics of the people in charge. Rivian founder and CEO R.J. Scaringe started the company using the Florida facilities of Mainstream Engineering, which was founded by his father, Robert Scaringe. Rivian was first named Mainstream Motors. Scaringe, the elder, has donated thousands of dollars to Republican candidates and causes, according to Federal Election Commission data, including to a MAGA election denier, California Representative Ken Calvert. A request to Rivian CEO and founder R.J. Scaringe for comment on energy policy and political climate, competitors in the EV space, and Musk went unanswered. The Atlanta exec who switched to Rivian said that he felt more comfortable with Scaringe. I know enough about RJ to know that I'm pretty sure he's not a Nazi and he's not going to try to destroy America anytime soon. Chinese automaker BYD could also make headway in the U.S. It's the biggest electric automaker in the world and outsells Tesla in non-Western countries. Its competitive price and outstanding battery recharge time, which made big waves in the U.S. when it was announced last week, have earned its praise and recent attention, though import issues and tariffs could impact a possible toehold in the U.S. market. No matter what car a driver chooses, it's not just a commodity for most people. Cars.com auto industry analyst David Green told Vanity Fair. I mean, that's a culture in itself, Green said. It's not just I need to be in a truck, but I'm a Ford truck guy or I'm a Chevy truck guy. And I mean, those lines never get crossed. Kelley Blue Book's Moody, too, had a working theory for why those who were able would take a financial loss in exchange for the symbolism of not driving a Tesla anymore. It's the American knee-jerk reaction, he said, to gain some sense of control in a world over which you have absolutely no control. Our next headline, Family Values. Pro-family House Republicans want a scuttle resolution allowing new parents to proxy vote. I am not going to destroy democracy by allowing female members to vote when recovering from birth, said GOP Representative Anna Paulina Luna of Florida. This is by Katie Hirschenroeder on March 29th. Republican leaders are intensifying their efforts to kill a bipartisan effort that would allow Congress members who are new parents and pregnant people who are unable to travel safely or have a serious medical condition to vote by proxy for up to 12 weeks. Representative Anna Paulina Luna, a Republican from Florida who co-sponsored the resolution, said this week that her colleagues have attempted to bribe and threaten her to remove support for the effort. These attempts, Luna said, haven't deterred her. I am not going to be bought. I will tell you that I've now been reached out to multiple times offering me positions on different committees, and I don't want it because this is bigger than me. Luna, who became the 12th lawmaker to give birth while serving in the House in 2023, told reporters on Thursday, "This is about actually changing the institution for the better." Representatives Luna, Colorado Democrat Brittany Peterson, California Democrat Sarah Jacobs, and Republican Mike Lawler of New York teamed up on the resolution, garnering the 218 signatures from the House members necessary for a discharge petition. This petition permits them to schedule a vote on the resolution even without the support of the chamber's leadership, meaning they have enough bipartisan support to force a vote in Congress. But some Republicans, including Speaker of the House Mike Johnson, are waging a war on the resolution, reportedly threatening Luna and her supporters with electoral consequences if they don't shutter the effort. And according to reporting from Politico, even supporting the bill has led some representatives to receive threats that they won't be helped with fundraising efforts or that their bills won't make it to the congressional floor. Johnson, who prides himself on being a leader for family values, has vocally opposed the resolution. "I'm a father. I'm pro-family. The Republican Party is pro-family. We want to make it as easy as possible for young parents to be able to participate in the process," Johnson told NPR about the push to change the rules for new parents. "But proxy voting, in my view, is unconstitutional." The speaker said the resolution could be a slippery slope to other exemptions. For some of the Republicans pushing the resolution, this is deeply personal. When Luna was pregnant, she developed high blood pressure right before giving birth, a potentially fatal condition known as preeclampsia that affects some pregnant people. She continued to struggle after birth, developing mastitis, an infection common among women who are nursing. This led her doctors to advise her not to travel back to Washington for a key vote at the time. "I just don't think it's fair to remove moms from the conversation," Luna told NBC. "I can't help having a baby. It's part of my life, and so I shouldn't be discriminated against because of it." Representative Peterson made headlines when in February she flew across the country with her four-week-old infant in order to vote no on the Republican budget proposal. She wanted a vote by proxy but wasn't allowed to. "Unfortunately, I wasn't given the opportunity to vote remotely after giving birth." The Congresswoman was again in Washington this week with her newborn to push for House members to sign onto the discharge petition. "Sam is only 6 weeks old," she said of her son, "but he got to be a part of changing hearts and minds and addressing a barrier that prevents regular people from serving in Congress." This brings us to the end of our time together here on the Vanity Fair Hour. Once again, you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and my name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I invite you to join me next week for another full hour of stories from Vanity Fair. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great week, everybody. Representative Peterson made headlines when, in February, she flew across the country with her four-week-old infant in order to vote no on the Republican budget proposal. She wanted to vote by proxy, but wasn't allowed to. Unfortunately, I wasn't given the opportunity to vote remotely. Oh.